First, to introduce myself, my name is Sean O'Shuckrew. I come from Dublin in Ireland. I'm with the CRIS campaign, that's Communication Rights in the Information Society, and I am the coordinator of the event here, working very closely with our partners in civil society, WAC, the World Association for Christian Communication, the Human Rights Caucus in the Information Society, APC, which is the Association for Progressive Communication, and the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Germany. The basic goal of the day is to explore communication rights, the idea of communication rights, and the reality, more important, of communication rights and what's important about them in their relationship to other social movements and to broader society. We don't begin this matter from, we don't wish to begin this discussion from a narrow perspective of communication and media, and indeed to some extent to fall into the same trap that we see the summit itself falling into. We recognize that the value of communication is in society as a whole, and it's not something to be pursued merely on its own account. It's not something that is just for, I suppose, activists like me and our friends here who are very concerned about what happens in media and communication. It's of concern to all of us, to all of society, especially to civil society, but to all of us. There are many trends in the last number of decades that are leading possibly to very serious situations. There are also very, very many hopeful activities and actors out there. And we want to be able to spend a few minutes on many stories that we will be presenting on both sides, the risks involved, and the positive, very positive elements that we see coming in the area of media and communication and what it means to people in their real lives. I am so much looking forward to what our speakers have to say. We begin with the first session on communication and poverty, entitled Out of Sight, Out of Mind, which is intended to indicate the fact that really in so many parts of the world and in so many media, the reality of poverty and the causes of poverty and what we can do about poverty is either ignored entirely or dealt with in really quite a dangerous fashion. And with that, I'm going to hand over to Pradeep Thomas from WAC to introduce the first session. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean, and welcome to the first session of the World Forum on Communication Rights on the theme Communication and Poverty, Out of Sight, Out of Mind. I think that it is apt that we have a session on poverty today because it remains a missing dimension in international communications, a reality that is barely acknowledged, but has been barely acknowledged by the WSIS process in the ways in which the world is represented to us by the media. Now, some of our friends in this building might be surprised to hear that innovations in global poverty has fast outstripped innovations in new technologies. Poverty remains a byproduct of pre-existing structures of disadvantage, compounded by a predatory economics and the politics of growth. And there's a visible reality in both the North and the South, but it's largely invisible in the eyes of the media. Why is this the case, and how has this come about? This session is largely on representations of poverty and the factors that make large sectors of the world's populations invisible, out of sight, out of mind. It affirms the communication rights of the poor, that they have a right to be heard, to be represented as communication, as human beings with dignity, their right to access, and it celebrates the use of the media to claim their rights and to create communication environments of their choice. Now, we've assembled a panel of experts to discuss some of these issues, and I'm going to introduce them to you, the man of the presentations. The first speaker will be Dennis Smith. right there at the end. Dennis Smith is a Guatemalan U.S. national, currently the president of WAC Latin America. He is widely known for his grassroots work, human rights-related work in Guatemala. He's written many books and done many productions, including recently a video on the truth and reconciliation process in Guatemala. And these are a testimony of his taking sides. He's a communication rights advocate, working with the ecumenical NGO SEDEPCA, and is also involved in monitoring labor rights in Guatemala with the verification of codes of conduct commission, COVERCO. I'd like to ask Dennis to start off the panel. Thank you.
Good morning. I'd like to share some stories from Guatemala, a small nation in Central America that has borne more than its share of suffering in recent decades. Guatemala has many voices, many faces, but few are seen and heard. You will find statistics in the almanacs and encyclopedias that will tell part of the story. Most Guatemalans are poor, most are women, most are illiterate, most are indigenous, bearers of the ancient Mayan cultures. But people fly from all over the planet to take photos of Guatemala's smoking volcanoes, our colonial churches, and especially of rural Mayan women in brightly colored traditional dress. But for most visitors, the human beings behind the dress remain anonymous and voiceless. You know that Rigoberta Menchú, a young Mayan woman, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1992. Did you know that one of the candidates in our current presidential campaign, when asked what role he saw for Ms. Menchú in his administration, responded that she would make an excellent ambassador to promote Guatemalan tourism? Who tells the stories? Who crafts the images? A study by Sirigua, an independent Guatemalan press agency, documents that between January 2002 and August 2003, Guatemala's newspapers reported the murders of 291 women. An additional 78 women were reported disappeared or kidnapped. 76 were reported wounded. Why such massive violence against women? Why no serious investigations? Why no priority policies to stop this violence? We began to listen to word on the street. We knew people who knew some of the victims. A young woman by the name of Sarah, another who was the daughter of a friend of a friend. And it turns out that these particular young women had become invisible. You see, they lived in poor, marginal zones rife with gang violence. So maybe they weren't so innocent after all, said the rumors. Maybe they were messing around with unsavory characters. Maybe it was their fault. Now they were dead. And who would tell their stories? November 25th in Latin America is the Day of Nonviolence Toward Women. And a woman's group set out in Central Park in Guatemala City just a couple of weeks ago to patch together a quilt with scraps of cloth on which passersby noted the names of women they knew who had been victims of violence. Not arranged ahead of time, just random women passing by in Central Park. Do you know a woman who has suffered violence? What is her name? Can you write it here on this piece of cloth? And in less than an hour, 30 names were collected. And the activity continued all day. Stories were told. Memories were rescued from anonymity. Who tells the stories? Who crafts the images? In Guatemala, we have our very own Rupert Murdoch clone. His name is Angel Gonzalez. Gonzalez is a Mexican who lives in Miami. He has media properties in many Latin American countries. In Guatemala, he owns all four commercial VHF television stations, other UHF frequencies, dozens of radio stations, a chain of cinemas, video stores, restaurants, the local Sears franchise. Each election year, all presidential candidates make the pilgrimage to Miami to talk to Don Angel. And all are welcome, and whoever wins, the continuation of the monopoly is assured. The problem with concentrating so many media frequencies in so few hands is that others are excluded. The electromagnetic spectrum, after all, is a non-renewable resource that is the patrimony of all humankind. Despite Angel Gonzalez, people in Guatemala find ways to craft their own images, to tell their own stories. And radio is the medium of choice in Guatemala because radio reaches everyone, everywhere. The Guatemalan Council of Community Communication has compiled a list of 240 community radio stations that are now on the air in Guatemala. And in recent years, council members have mounted a bold public policy initiative to have Congress regulate community radio and television. In the meantime, they insist, they are illegal, not illegal, because they are authorized by the peace accords, by the Constitution, by international law to meet the communication needs of their communities. They have legislation pending before Congress. In the meantime, the stories being lived out in their communities must be told. Here is what I see in towns and urban neighborhoods that have community radio. People have a communication space where they speak their own language, sing their own songs, discuss their own problems. I hear neighbors demand accounts of local elected officials. How did the mayor establish budget priorities? Is it acceptable, Mr. Mayor, that you hired only members of your own family to build the new market? This is the space where accountability and civic activism is cultivated. Here, people come to understand that national government also can and must be held accountable. Angel Gonzalez won't tell these stories. Indeed, Angel Gonzalez and other major commercial broadcasters complain that the community radios interfere with their frequencies. They say the community radios are pirates and they must be fined, they must be silenced. But are the commercial frequencies sticking to their allotted power, their allotted bandwidth? Curiously, no one seems to know. Once people begin to tell their stories, they won't be silenced easily. Just one final comment. Information and communication technologies are not an end in themselves. The technologies are vehicles for connecting human beings, for telling stories, for crafting images, for distributing cultural products. Yes, we understand that technologies are a platform for commercial enterprise. That's fine. The mitigating factor is that in our world, these technologies have become the bearers of our common dreams, our common hopes, our common values. Humanity's common dreams simply cannot be reduced to the Cola Wars, the Nike swoosh, and Sony gadgets. Nor can our world be reduced to the platitudes and titillation of global media conglomerates run by the likes of Murdoch and Angel Gonzalez. We are many voices, many faces, and the world is bigger, more nuanced, and infinitely more diverse than the world portrayed by the commercial media. many voices, many faces, and that is why access to frequencies, access to technologies, access to the spaces where meaning and values are created in our world is a fundamental human right. Denial of this access is a form of cultural violence. History tells us that once people are silenced, made invisible, it is but a short step to the loss of language, the loss of identity, the loss of unique ways of being in this world, indeed, the loss of life itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Who tells the stories? Who crafts the images? We are many voices. Our second speaker, Sherry Honkala, next to Dennis, is from the USA and is the director of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, a union representing the unemployed. She is recognized as one of the leading anti-poverty activists in the USA, championing the rights of the poor, homeless, unemployed civil society. A recipient of numerous awards, Sherry Honkala has, through her passionate activism, turned issues of poverty into a national concern. Formerly homeless herself, Sherry Honkala has consistently tried to fight for better domestic welfare policies, testified at Congress and at other international gatherings, and for all her efforts has been at the receiving end of the law, which only seems to have strengthened her resolve to expose and fight poverty in the richest country in the world. Sherry.
Good morning. We're going to begin with a short clip. It's a scene in which we're demonstrating in the United States outside of the corporate headquarters and the factory of Pillowtex that has just laid off 4,000, not laid off, eliminated the jobs of 4,600 families in Kannapolis, North Carolina.
The sooner that we get the signs up and it looks like a huge message, the press have something to report. If there's no signs up that have no message on it and they take us down before we're able to get those things up, then that's where we're going to have a problem, because we'll be locked up and it'll be like, what was the message? Why were they doing this?
I got to tie a knot on this motherfucker and it keeps ripping. Yeah. You hold it right here.
Need some rope.
Just put the rope on the bottom of this. Or put the tape on the bottom of this. Sergeant, please, 10 more minutes.
You're not answering my question.
The people that own this property are going to create a situation where all the families in this town, and also you guys' jobs and your friends and loved
ones
are
affected.
Sherry Honkala, C-H-E-R-I-H-O-N-K-A-L-A.
Okay, and what group do you represent, ma'am?
I'm the National Poor People's Campaign.
Okay. Do you understand that? Now, we want to make sure that we're clear on this. You can't break the law.
Supposedly, somebody told us that they had a permit for us, so
there's
can you
no
give me 5 minutes?
You don't need a permit.
You can't want to verify that.
You can't get a permit
give
for private property.
Officers, you can give me 5 minutes.
You can't get
five
a
minutes.
We'll give you 5 minutes.
Give me 5 minutes.
No
Thank
problem.
You.
Okay.
5 minutes.
No problem.
We're setting up NAFTAville. And Pillowtex is NAFTAville, USA. It's a symbol of what's happening in this country. Factories are leaving, and they're not coming back.
We're not making any kind of threats to your group at all. We don't do that, but we will arrest you if you haven't vacated the property.
What are these families going to do with health care, with their kids starting school, with the rest of their lives, actually? We know some of the aches and pains that the local folks are experiencing. We got together to also shine a light at a time when there's been a blackout in terms of media in different parts of the country.
Okay. Well, I went down to the rich man's house and I took back what he stole from me. I took back my dignity. I took back my humanity. Well, I went down.
I'm going to go, you know, send an email to all the elected officials so they know what's going on. Okay. I'll keep in touch. All right, Mayor. Bye-bye.
Police arrest four activists Friday who were members of the group protesting Pilotech's job losses outside Plant 1. The activists are members of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign based in Philadelphia. The group is traveling to D.C. to highlight what they call economic human rights. They lean the mattress with NAFTAville writing in big black letters. The name refers to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement that critics say have cost hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs.
This is on the front page of the Independent Tribune. Honka will blame politicians, including U.S. Representative Robin Hayes and U.S. Senator Elizabeth Dole, in a statement issued Friday. The votes of these lawmakers have sent American jobs overseas, leaving families without money for rent or school supplies. We're indicting Hayes and Dole for economic human rights violations. Jonathan Feltz, communication director for Hayes, said Congressman Hayes has never voted for an international trade agreement in Congress.
The day he voted and all of that stuff for his communications director today when we go in front of their building.
So I have a short amount of time to say a whole lot of things because part of my presentation was the clip. But I think that you get the idea. Pretty much you hold a press conference in the United States of America or you try and talk about what's happening, and all you do is you send out a press release and the police department shows up, and then you can ensure the communications director will then issue a statement which will then become reality and will be the thing printed in the paper the next day while you stand trial for trying to raise your voice about the conditions existing in our country. I bring you greetings from poor and homeless families in the United States. We're not interested in pity. We want to change these conditions. I'm not a communications professional. Nobody has yet decided to print anything that I have written or any books. My degree comes from living the actual life of a homeless mother in a very wealthy country. With the ending of our social welfare system as an entitlement, and with 44 million people without health insurance, with mothers having their children taken away from them because they are poor and because they speak out, we have more people in prison for economic crimes than any place else in the entire world. And where we live, we have an actual death penalty for children. We have to ask ourselves some very serious questions. Why are we hiding poverty in the United States of America? Why don't we see the faces of the people who die every single day in our rich country because they froze to death on the streets of America? Why do we not see the faces of those that die every single day in our country because they don't have health care and the other basic necessities of life? Why do we not see the photographic images? Why do we not see the films? Why do we not see these faces on CNN? We have to ask ourselves these serious questions. Why is it that my son laid down every single night and I had to wonder whether or not he would freeze to death come the next morning when in my country there are more abandoned houses than there are homeless people, and where in my country it is not a question of development, it is not a question of scarcity? I'll tell you why. Because we have been made to disappear. Disappear from every television, every printed paper, billboard, and radio station to continue to create a false image of the reality that is happening in our country. There is nothing worse than being poor and being homeless in the United States of America and having your voice cut off while you lay outside of luxury units, or when you have to turn on the television to see that $87 billion is being spent to kill people in Iraq or Afghanistan or someplace else in the world while you can't even feed or house your own children. The police show up when we send out media advisories. In Miami, when we fought against the FTAA, the head of the Miami Herald called our attorney back in Philadelphia and threatened that we would be arrested. I will continue to go to jail, regardless of the charges that are constantly being put against me, and the fact that my most recent charge, I face charges of 22 years in jail. For what? For daring to talk about homelessness in the United States of America. We need your help in the United States. We need intervention. We need the international community to intervene and to tell the true story about what's happening in our country. Our very survival depends on breaking this media blackout. All we need to do in order to alleviate this problem is to see it. Then we, as good people in our country and the global community, will end the problem. But if we continue to participate in allowing the United States of America's media and corporations to keep us invisible and to never tell the true story of poverty in America, we will never end it. Thank you.
Who tells the stories indeed? The next speaker, right next to me, Kate Azuka Omunega, is from Nigeria, although currently at the University of Gloucestershire, where she's in the process of completing her doctoral studies on issues related to the media, gender, culture, and representation. And she will speak to issues related to women, poverty, and the media.
I must say that I use poverty in this presentation in a multidimensional sense that is not limited to income poverty alone. It also embraces loss of rights and dignity, powerlessness, inequality, vulnerability, and about access and control of resources. For 2 years now, and as part of my doctoral research, what I've been doing is studying the media in Nigeria, how women are represented in the media, the newspapers especially. So what I shall be doing today is to share with you how I think Nigerian media perpetuate the poverty of Nigerian women. One thing that seemed to be glaring in the Nigerian media is the near absence of women as newsmakers. One possible reason for this is the new news value, which privileges prominence. That is who is involved. Closely related to this again is that the Nigerian media seem to work with the ideology of what we call developmental communication. In this case, we find out that the media are seen as a mouthpiece of the government to communicate development. It is ironical that a combination of these two ideologies, the news values, which privileges prominence, and the ideology of developmental communication, instead of giving voice to people, really lead to a culture of silence. What do I mean by that? What I simply mean is that because the news media privileged prominence, who said becomes more important than what is said. The maker of the news becomes more important than the news itself. So that the poor, who definitely do not qualify as prominent, seem to be gradually disappearing from the media, to be replaced by the rich, the affluent, the government officials, the heads of government, etc., what they said or what they did. I'll give you an instance. If you listen to Nigerian media, maybe the radio, television, or read their newspapers, what you simply see is maybe a caption can go like this. A former head of state has advised government to provide rural community with good drinking water in order to fight guinea worms. And then what we see flash liberally over the pages of the newspapers or in the radio or in the television are the pictures and photographs of these people who said, that's the head, the former head of state. These people who are supposed to make the news, these people who suffer from guinea worms, they don't come out, they don't feature at all. Why should they? Because they are not really people whom they want to make the news. Who really makes the news is who said and not what he said. Again, what we find out that another potential trend which you find in the media about women is that when they do get reported, these are women who are appendages to the men in power, especially their wives. What I've called the first lady syndrome. So that when you listen to the radio, television, or read the newspapers, what you see or hear is the wife of the governor of Anambra State, Mrs. So-so-so, was in a fundraising whatever for maybe to aid children. Things like that. So that when they do make news, they don't make news because of whom they are. They make news because they are the wives of men in power. Again, you notice that the media in Nigeria do not miss out the opportunity to criminalize the poor. I'll cite an example with the social malaise in the country now, which is on human trafficking. Human trafficking is a transnational social problem that is an organized crime, really, which at the moment seem to defy solution. Recently, Nigeria signed a bilateral cooperation with Italy and Belgium to fight this crime. These girls are often lured into prostitution. Sometimes they are as young as 12 and often come from very poor families. They suffer a lot in the destination country. And usually when they are repatriated, what do the media do? They traumatize them further by what they leave out unsaid. What you see is their photographs splashed on the daily newspapers or in the television, criminalizing them so that the victims become the criminals. Nothing is said about these people who are really the perpetrators of this crime. And it is on record that up to today, none of these people who are involved in the crime have been apprehended or successfully prosecuted. So the representation of women in the media throws up certain key myths and stereotypes that circulate about women within the Nigerian society. One is that their lives seem to revolve around the men, either as wives, mothers, mother-in-laws, or daughters. Two is the centrality of marriage to define the success of any woman in Nigeria is really found by the media. Again, it seems to say that women outside the protection of a man is a disaster, and women are best at hearth and home. For want of time, I'm just simply going to leave it at that, but there's true of so many key stereotypes that are prevalent in the media. Women in Nigeria recognize the damaging nature of this representation and have tried really to resist as much as they can to challenge these stereotypes and myths. One major way in which they have done this is through the women groups. What I've tried to do is to sponsor the production of radio programs and jingles in English and indigenous languages to promote the images of women and present alternative representation. Especially, they emphasize the success that there are successful women in male-dominated professions. Owning something like a community radio for them is out of the question because of the high price placed on radio license in Nigeria, which is as high as maybe $20,000. So what happens is that those who own the media are really friends of government, really the same men in power who have the economic power. We need to break this culture of silence. We really need to tackle this problem within the Nigerian media. I'll tell you my experience when I went home for a field work in Nigeria. I needed about 15 women as part of my research, people that I'm going to discuss with and talk with. The major criterion for that was that there must be women who read the newspapers regularly. The hunt began, and it was amazing how difficult it was to get just 15 women who read newspapers regularly. not because they don't want to, but because within the economic realities of the country, buying a newspaper is a luxury they could ill afford. We may now ask ourselves, what do you think in the face of the concerns for economic gains by most of our media in our various countries, what do you think is the possible position of such women who cannot afford to buy the commodity of the media? They might be left out of the center, and that is what actually the poor in Nigeria, especially the women, really say. What I've said so far really throws up some communication rights of women that need to be addressed within the Nigerian scenario. They have, one is the right to be heard and not be silenced, the right to be fairly represented and not misrepresented, the right to have access to the media. Affordable access should be a right and not a privilege. And I was thinking, we need perhaps to redefine our news values. We need to redefine our news values so that we don't always privilege the very prominent. We also need to revisit the general media, maybe code of ethics and practice that stipulate gender fair reporting. This could inspire journalists to include not just more stories on women, but stories that might reflect their diverse activities as well. Because the radio has been known to break the triple barriers of illiteracy, language and reach, the government of Nigeria need to make it more accessible to the people through encouraging community radios. One way to do this is to revisit the astronomical high radio license. This way, the poor women could be involved both in the production and the participation in the media. Nigerian media and other key players should realize that the exclusion of Nigerian women implies the exclusion of majority of Nigerians who are trapped in the cycle of poverty. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. And our keynote speaker today is Palagumi Sainath. Sainath is really one of his kind, a journalist committed to making the voices of the unacknowledged heard. He's the leading anti-poverty journalist in India, and his against-the-grain reporting has earned him many awards, including Amnesty International's first global human rights journalism prize. He has spent many years reporting the lives of the rural poor in India, about 8 months a year, where he spends in rural India. And his best-selling book, Everybody Loves a Good Drought, is a must-read, and this is his book. It's in its 12th edition. A crusading journalist, his work has been described as the conscience of the Indian nation, and he's been recognized as an expert on famine and poverty by no less an authority than the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. His photographic exhibition, which is on my right there, entitled Visible Work, Invisible Women, captures his passion and commitment to the cause of the rural poor, and it's this particular exhibition has seen by nearly 500,000 people in India. Let me call upon Sainath to give the keynote.
The big advantage of speaking at the end of a panel like this is that everybody else does the work and you can throw in a little commentary. I think it was Australia's Alex Carey who said that there were three great developments in the 20th century. The first, it was the rise of democracy. The second is the rise of corporate power. And the third is the rise of corporate media propaganda to help corporate power stifle the rise of democracy. Those, he says, were the three great events of the 20th century, and I am inclined to agree. I think we need to place this, you've heard some fantastic accounts of a cumulative assault, especially, you know, on the living standards of the poor. On what's a global assault on poor people. It's happening in most countries of the world, if not all. And I think we need to also look at it in the context of the dominant ideologies and the dominant processes of our time, which we can ideologically call market fundamentalism. Okay? And the media are the flag bearers of what I call market fundamentalism. Inequality has grown faster in the world in the last 10 years than it has in the preceding 40. It has grown faster at any time since World War II. In India, we face a period of inequality unseen since the colonial period, and it's developed in the last 10 to 12 years. China, once one of the most egalitarian societies in the world, is today marked by swiftly growing disparity between rural, poor, and urban areas, between coastal and interior areas. Africa has lost one-fifth of all her income in the last 25 years, and the distress of millions of Africans is something enormous, and as you've been told, they're made to be invisible. We need to ask whether poverty and the poor are invisible or the media and the elite are willfully blind. Which is real? Which is more real? Are they invisible or are we blind? And I was just listening the night before last to television, and I was being told that Afghanistan is the fastest growing economy in the world. It's growing at over 20% this year. Of course, they forgot to mention that more than 50% of the growth came from opium. Yeah. So in this period of, Sherry gave you this incredible description of what's happening in the United States, and I think it's very important. Inequality in the United States has never been greater since 1929, since the eve of the Great Depression. It has never been worse since that point in time. As I said, in fact, it's reached such a stage that 2 months ago we had a most spectacularly funny series of statements. We had a statement denouncing inequality and poverty and the concentration of wealth and the concentration of riches. When I read it, I thought it was Subcomandante Marcos of the Zapatistas. It turned out to be Wolfensohn of the World Bank making the statement. And he said, markets are not everything, you know. This was at the Dubai meeting. Shortly after that, the IMF is quoted in a single line in the Herald Tribune as saying, well, you know, Mahathir may not be a nice guy, but in the argument we had with him over the East Asian crisis, yeah, we were wrong. He was right. And markets are not everything, and controls are sometimes needed. And then the Oracle spoke. I read the Wall Street Journal, and it has this incredible line for the Wall Street Journal, the Oracle of Global Capital. It says, markets are a wonderful way of organizing economic activity. But let's face it, they need adult supervision. Gee, if they'd figured this out 20 years ago, hundreds of millions of people would have been spared all kinds of misery. You know? Now, I think the World Bank, the WTO, the IMF, and the Wall Street Journal need adult supervision. You know? In this complex of Palexpo where we are gathered, one of the great success stories I understand being cited in the ICTs for development in various fora in this complex, the Indian success story is being told and told and retold. If you take out the folder provided so kindly and generously by Nokia, which is in your folder, there's a brochure by Nokia, which tells you about the success story of mobile phones in the state of Rajasthan in India, and India itself is this great success story where cell phones are concerned. What they don't tell you is tele-density in India is one of the lowest in the world. It's less than 5%. And the state of Rajasthan being cited as the success story has perhaps the lowest tele-density in the major Indian states. Okay? Oh, by the way, they reach a tele-density of 5% by counting every cell phone as a separate owner from land phone owners. So they get you twice the amount of numbers when it's actually about 2.5%. This is the great, ICT and IT revolution. What is it that the professional communicators, the professional media persons, do not tell you today in the media? Let's take this great success story of India. They do not tell you that the largest number of absolute poor and hungry in the world still live in India. They do not tell you that in this period that they claim is a success, the United Nations Human Development Report records a slide in India's ranking in human development from 124 to 127 in the nations of the world, and that it is today better to be a poor person in Botswana or even the occupied territories of the Palestine than in India. This is, you can look it up in the UN Human Development Report. what the media do not tell you is that the Supreme Court of India has pulled up six major states three times in the last year over hunger deaths, over the rising incidence of hunger deaths that never happened between 1943, the Bengal famine, and 1991, when the onset of neoliberal globalism begins. The media do not tell you this, that the Supreme Court has pulled up six major states three times in the last year. They do not tell you that in this incredible success story, in March this year, the food availability per Indian, remember that the largest number of absolute poor live in that country, the food availability per Indian in March 2003 was lower by 7 kilograms than it was during the Bengal famine. The New York Times has a front page celebrating the success story on October 20th this year. The Financial Times had one just 4 or 5 days ago talking to you about the huge explosion of the mall culture. It's true. A section of people are richer than they have ever been before. A section of people are eating better than they have ever eaten before. And yet, on a lowered food production base, 50 million tons of food are lying unpurchased because the purchasing power of the bottom 30% has collapsed. They do not tell you about the explosion of rural debt that has given India perhaps the largest number of farmers' suicides in the last 5 years, perhaps the largest in the world outside of China, for which we do not have proper figures. They do not tell you that the richest state in India, Maharashtra, has been bankrupted by a single deal with Enron, and that the one country in the world where Enron remains a legal entity is India. They do not tell you about the collapse of thousands of small farms, leading to an exodus of labor from the countryside into the cities where there is no work to be had because liberalization and privatization have closed thousands of factories, costing millions of jobs in the factories. They do not tell you that. They do not tell you that the number of registered people at the employment exchanges, the unemployed people registered at the exchanges, which is only a fraction of the total unemployed, is now 44 million. If you put those 44 million in a queue, that's three times the Indian coastline. It's 22,000 kilometers. They do not tell you about the resurgence of malaria, of tuberculosis, in a country that had actually controlled malaria by 1980s. Welcome to market fundamentalism. Welcome to neoliberal globalism. Welcome to this extremely aggressive phase of globalism. Even in this misery, the corporations make profit. The wonderful thing that I read a month ago, the wonderful thing which you can look up in the Herald Tribune, is to fight malaria, contractors have been hired in Japan and the United States and elsewhere to distribute nets impregnated, that's their word, with antimalarial chemicals, to fight the malaria parasite. Now they're going to distribute millions of bed nets to people who don't have beds. That's one thing. Second, the malaria parasite is not most active when you sleep. It's most active at dawn and dusk. Now, of course, you could make a whole new fashion statement by walking about in your malaria net, but it might cramp your style as an agricultural laborer at work. I think that you have to look at what's going on as a whole package. Just take the way the world went into hysterics over SARS. It's a very important disease. It's one of the first globalized diseases. SARS, why did SARS hit China so badly? Why did it panic the beautiful people so badly? 800 people died from SARS in 4 months. That's less than the number of people who die in a day from tuberculosis in India. But SARS threatens the beautiful people. SARS germs, they are notorious for their non-observance of class distinctions. They fly club class to New York and the West and they scare the hell out of everybody, right? The reason China got SARS, the reason China suffered such a big beating in SARS was for the last 15 years, China has been dismantling her rural health system. You accessed your health through the factory, through the local workplace, through the local school network. In the last 10 years, thousands of factories have closed down in China and workers have lost access to health. The old chain, alarm signal chain that went up from the village to the city to the laboratories, saying there's a new disease here, that collapsed because millions of poor Chinese lost access to health. Why China? We are worrying about 800 people in SARS. By cutting health budgets in France, you saw 15,000 French senior citizens die in the month of August. The overwhelming number of those who died were senior citizens who have faced health budget cuts in the last 10, 15 years. French parliamentarians have been demanding a debate on the issue. I don't know whether they've had it yet. Look at the, I was really interested to find in the New York Times an item that the American police are conducting raids on the Canadian-American border, particularly in Michigan, because lots of poorer Americans are trying to buy cheaper medicines across the border, and pharmacists in Michigan are stocking these cheaper medicines. So the Gestapo are now storming pharmacies on the American side of the border to punish people for buying cheaper medicines across the border in Canada. It's a worldwide thing. It's not just India. It's not just Africa. It's a worldwide assault on the poor. And the media are at the forefront of it, far from signaling the weakness, which is the fundamental duty of the media. They are singing the praises of the strong. Conventional journalism is about the service of power. It is about the service of power. I think the fundamental features, when we had last year the largest agricultural crisis in India's history, with over 2,000 farmers committing suicide in 9 states, with 600 in the rich agricultural state of Punjab. At this time, what was the biggest event in the media? The biggest event in our newly globalized media got 400,000 words, 500,000 words in print, over 1,000 minutes of television coverage, 800 hours of TV footage was shot, over 12,000 rolls of film were exposed, 500,000 pictures were shot, and over 1,000 pictures were published on the Lakme India Fashion Week. The number of journalists covering the worst agricultural crisis in India's history, full-time for a week, were 6. 6 journalists in a country which is the size of a subcontinent were covering the worst agricultural crisis in our history when food per person was less than that during the time of the Bengal famine. Number of journalists accredited to the Lakme India Fashion Week, 412. Now, the number of people of Indian citizens who access fashion accessories and wear designer clothes, according to the industry, is less than 0.2% of the population. Number of people dependent on agriculture, 650 million. 6 journalists, 412 journalists. Friends, 2 things have basically happened. One is the fundamental disconnect of the mass media from mass reality. The second is now the phase of the mass media versus mass reality, the assault on mass reality. This isn't happening. This isn't true. So all the rights that you heard about, whether it's the right to be heard, the right to express oneself, they're under assault from that same complex of market fundamentalism, of corporate dominance throughout the world. Inequality is growing in such a fantastic way. It's seen in every, in the media. You saw this year the phenomenal, the phenomenon of embedded journalism. Embedded journalism is a state of the mind. From covering the war they did, they are now covering the loot of Iraq in a very gentle fashion. Halliburton gets this. Countries that did not support the war are excluded from contracts for the reconstruction of Iraq. And by the way, in little footnotes you find that 15 children have been bombed to death in Afghanistan, and the U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel goes on to say, we're very surprised to know there were children there. What a strange place for children to be in their homes at night while sleeping, right? But there is good news. There are things you can do. There are things all of us can do. One, and I find this incredible, how people are communicating, how people are finding ways to reach across multiple boundaries. The classic example came in that very war against Iraq. At a time when the dominant sections of the global media were so pro-war, were so absolutely in favor of the war, when the dominant US media was pushing war down your throats, for the first time in history, we saw gigantic anti-war demonstrations before the war. And that is really something worth cherishing, worth understanding how positive a development that is. You had anti-war demonstrations not when the body bags came home, but before a war broke out. Some of the largest demonstrations against the war took place before the war broke out. I think that's a very, very important thing. I think it's important, despite the media barrage on his behalf, a US president enters election year fearful of defeat. A British prime minister is at his lowest ebb in popularity and is actually scared of losing his job. In Venezuela, people went out to rescue a government they wanted in a coup which the New York Times wrote an editorial supporting, and then, of course, backed off when the coup failed, but they wrote an editorial supporting it. In Bolivia,
people marched on the streets to cancel an energy deal that a corrupt government had entered into the United States, had entered into with the United States, and saw, not only did they cancel the deal, they canceled their president in the process as well. In Seattle, in Cancun, in Davos, whether it's in Porto Alegre, maybe in Mumbai in January, people are reaching across and beyond the formal boundaries of the media to communicate in very different ways. They are finding answers. They are finding ways. They're at least asking the right questions. I think we need, in the face of this incredible explosion of inequality worldwide, of which media inequality is one aspect, I think we need an explosion of popular media. I think we need an explosion of creativity, whether it's like the example of the Omai News in Korea or some of the other very interesting experiments that are going on where people are bypassing some of the formal boundaries and yet being able to force themselves onto the mainstream media. I think that's very important too. I think it's important to be in the mainstream media, to be against the mainstream media, to force it from very, very different directions. One of the things we've learned in the last 40, 50 years is that war is too important a thing to be left to the generals. That national security is too important a thing to be left to the experts, and that economics is simply too important to be left to the economists. I think we now need to desperately need to learn that media and communication are simply too important to be left to the professionals. Sherry was saying she's not a communications professional. I'm glad. I'm glad you're not. I think we need to rescue it from the professionals. I'm thinking of a concept of the guerrilla journalist, ambush the mainstream, work in it. In Kalahandi region, one of the poorest regions of India, young people from families that have seen suicides of farmers are trying to be journalists. They are communicating. They're managing to put things into the local press. They are writing a book about their experiences. Okay? We are doing recordings of some of those farmers who committed suicide in Andhra Pradesh. Their widows, their family members, and others too are going on record to say what they have to say about the dispensation that has caused 2,400 suicides in a single district in the country. Farm suicides are not just taking place in India. They're taking place in the United States. They're taking place in Canada. They're taking place in many rich countries as the small farms collapse. But we hear the voices of Monsanto and Cargill clear and loud in the media. Where are the voices of the farming communities? Who will be that guerrilla journalist? You know what? You all can. It's only a matter of trying. Thank you.
The first session of the World Forum on Communication Rights on the theme Communication and Poverty, Out of Sight, Out of Mind. Palagumi Sainath, keynote.
Thank you.